Butch Walker has said that he owes his success as a songwriter and producer to his failure as a 1980s hair metal rock star. He's worked with artists like Pink, Taylor Swift, and Katy Perry, and was named Rolling Stone's Hot Producer of the Year in 2005. He's also released a number of solo albums. And now he's written a memoir about his experiences in the music industry called Drinking with Strangers, Music Lessons from a Teenage Bullet Belt. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased it has brought Butch Walker to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You describe yourself as a mid-level artist, which you say is someone who has talent but is both too smart and too stupid to sell out effectively.
Did I write that?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Is there that much of a temptation to sell out?
I think so. I think a lot of people have it. I mean, sadly, I didn't grow up with as punk ethos as a lot of people in music did, where it just didn't matter. And it mattered to me because all I grew up on was AM radio in the 70s and then FM in the 80s. And whatever was popular on pop and rock radio is all I knew because there was no internet then. There was no, there was nothing. It was just basically, if you could tune in a station out in my hick town that I lived in, then that's what I heard and that's what I grew up on.
So you want to make hit records. You didn't want to create anarchy in the UK or something like that.
At least not at 8 years old. much later I did.
Are you willing to name some of the other mid-level artists that you were talking about?
I'm trying to think of who those are. They're a very special breed. But, you know, there's just certain people, I think, that that if you're lucky enough to transcend a one-hit wonder status, I suppose, and still have people want to listen to your music and take it seriously and come see your concerts. I feel like I've gotten there right now, and I'm pretty happy about that because we definitely had brushes of with the Kiss of Death one-hit wonder, you know, in my previous efforts.
Now, Rogers was on the show last week, and even though a lot of people don't know his solo work, they are familiar with the records he's produced. Why is it that so many musicians in this mid-level category wind up working as producers?
Well, I think it's a natural progression if you know your way around a studio, obviously, and know your way around playing different instruments. The one thing that to me was fascinating about it was I was completely broke, working overworked and underpaid as all artists are, but I didn't want to ever just give that up. I wanted to do my art, or my music. I don't, it's pretentious to call my music art, but like to do my own music without worrying about whether or not I was going to be able to feed my kid. And what made it cool to produce and actually break in that world was I was able to, I can afford to put some food on the table and still do what I want to do and not worry about whether or not it's fashionable or hot at the moment. And producing just was something that came naturally to me because I started on a 4-track cassette recorder back when I was 15 years old and learning the art of overdubbing, sound on sound recording, and making all the local bands' demos in town. And then it just progressed into, you know, I was infatuated with the process. You know?
Now, if you get a decent mic and you have a computer with GarageBand in it, you can make professional sounding.
GarageBand is a verb now, almost. I mean, it can be like, oh, you GarageBand that song. I can smell it on the radio. I can hear it. I know.
You can hear the difference.
I can hear a lot of the same samples, built-in loops, and music sound bites that come in the catalog when you get GarageBand, because I've used those for writing tools, and that it is beautiful to see that happen in music, where a kid can make a record and it sounds like a professional record.
It's democratizing the business.
It is. It separates the good from the bad, because I think there was a lot of bad, you know, music coming out for years that labels would sign, and it wouldn't always be the best bands getting that shot.
You say that when you grew up, you idolized music from artists with a glamorous edge. Bands like Kiss and Van Halen were among your favorites. How much of that over-the-top production finds its way into your music?
Well, I couldn't sound further from that now, being 41 years old and being settled into my own little, you know, comfortable skin of music that I do.
And you don't have big hair anymore.
Oh, God, no. That would look really ridiculous on a 41-year-old.
Oh, I've seen a few.
I've still got a lot of friends in that world. But the thing is, you know, when you're a kid and your first concert is Kiss when you're 8 years old, at the height of their just bombast and, you know, over the top, it the circus pales in comparison after that. And so I was very attracted to the visual side of music as well as the audio side, because that's all I didn't have MTV until 1980. So pre that, it was all like album covers and posters. I would obsess over these groups and how tough AC/DC looked, and how it, so it was like hard rock bands usually, although Parliament and Funkadelic were a visual display for sure, and you know, for not being a rock band.
So how much of it is all about the pose? You started as a glam rock musician.
Well, I think that's the whole, that's my whole rant, is that at the end of the day, it's not about that. But to get there and to appreciate it, I had to go through it. And I definitely went through many hairs, as I like to call it. Different styles, different things that I would never want to do again. Things that drugs, alcohol, and the 80s will do to you. So I was kind of, I'm glad I went through it, but it's like looking at a high school yearbook photo. I don't ever want to go back to that. So I'd rather make it more about music now.
Your hair metal band called Bite the Bullet was later renamed South Gang.
Original name.
And then you moved to L.A. from your hometown of Cartersville, Georgia.
Yeah.
That must have been a major culture shock.
It was the ultimate culture shock. I moved out there straight from, a farming town and, with a very conservative and religious background and resistance, obviously. And I get out there and I get thrown right into, which we called the heavy metal Mardi Gras every night.
Well, there was a cutthroat L.A. music scene.
It was big.
So how did you survive? You obviously weren't
$15
totally
a week. $15 a week groceries, five for a dollar generic brand mac and cheese, generic beer, five guys living in a one-bedroom, non-air-conditioned apartment on Hollywood Boulevard.
But also there's a desire to be like everybody else and not be like everybody else. How do you work that out?
Well, that was the hard part. Was we walked into L.A. and there was 5,000 bands that looked and sounded all the same, and we were like, oh man, we're nothing special. We were like big fish, little pond, back home. But you get out there, and all of a sudden, there was also in that genre, which is obviously it's kind of a tacky, vapid, genre of music to get lumped into anyway, where it was not a lot of substance. It was a lot of flash and a lot of style. So one thing we at least tried to do was all be good musicians and good singers, because we grew up on the 70s bands that were all good players. So
because there were so many bands where the guitarist knew three chords and that was it.
Yeah, and Kiss obviously was that band when I was eight, but I grew out of that and got into bands that were better than that.
Your first major label record was produced by Howard Benson, who's done some impressive work over the years. Listening back to it now, what do you think of the records that he made with South Gang?
I don't listen to them because I think they're terrible, but that's like the worst, to me, that we were the nail in the coffin for that genre anyway. And Howard had not produced a lot of records at that time or broke. So he was sort of a no name in the business.
And he was learning with you.
He was learning with me, and I was learning a lot of kind of what not to do, actually, because we were, treated like crap.
But he made you want to be a producer, you say.
In a way, yeah, it was the adversity, I was like, I'm going to learn how to do this just to spite you, because you're such a butthead to me, but looking back on it, it was good boot camp and good training.
Now, you also were one of the first American bands to tour China. This is when China was opening up. What are some of the parts of the tour that stick out in your memory 20 years later?
Oh, my God. There's so many. It would take an hour. It was such a culture shock for us just to go over there and be these country bumpkin kids in our early 20s walking into this third world where there was just, live food flopping on your plate in front of you to eat. Which now doesn't seem to be a big deal to me, but back then, there was a lot of people approaching us, for drugs and things, which you could get locked up seriously for life there if you did that. And we were a young, stupid rock band going over there doing that. And, Just the amount. You know what was one of the best things is I went over there, and that's when I really opened up my views about spirituality and religion, because after coming from the town that I came from where it was just Methodist, Christian, that's it. Obviously, anything else that exists, you're going to hell if you believe in. And I go over there, and I visited the Buddhist temples, and that really kind of changed things. I had questions after that.
You say that... part of your success as a solo artist and a producer is that your hair metal band failed.
Oh, man. If we would have been big, I think it would have been over. Like, it would have been over for me.
Like
now,
so many of those other bands that had their moment, and then you wonder whatever happened to them.
And a lot of them, sadly, are tortured from it, and so much that it can and has killed several of them. And I'm fortunate, you know, that I didn't end up in that category, so to speak.
But you actually had a spin-off band called from South Gang called Marvelous Three.
Yes.
The record company didn't know that you were just really South Gang renamed?
Redux. Yeah, they didn't know that because it was right when the internet was starting to happen, and we were playing some really cruel jokes on A&R guys at the time that were recording our band, because we were all still pretty young, but young-looking, and but we were, you know, 27, 28 years old at that time, which was a little bit older than the typical alt-rock band at the time, and so they didn't know that we already had been through this whole shuffle.
But you came along at a time when the major labels were still powerful, but were about to lose their clout.
That's right. They were about to lose a lot of power to the digital age.
So how much of an adjustment did you make? Were the artists aware of just how fast the world was changing?
Not
many. Because the companies weren't.
No, the companies slept. They were asleep at the wheel on the whole thing. And if you actually go back in time, I remember I got my first MP3 player pre-iPod, pre-Apple, called a Diamond Rio. And I believe it held maybe like 10 songs. And I remember it being the devil's tool. Like, if you walked into a radio station or a record company and you had one of those, you were the bad guy. And I had one, and I remember everybody just, it was so shunned upon, you know, and frowned upon. And I just remember how the labels just completely fell asleep at the wheel during that.
But your goal was still to be with a major label, wasn't it?
I think it was due to that, what we talked about at the beginning. I still was at an insecure place where I really wanted to be viable in the commercial world. I really wanted to make it, so to speak. I wanted to be successful. And when, you know, I guess that was after a couple of failed attempts with some major labels trying to be that, I realized I was never really going to be that guy.
My guest is Butch Walker, who, with the help of Matt Deal, has written Drinking with Strangers, Music Lessons from a Teenage Bullet Belt. The book is published by William Morrow. You had a hit song with Marvelous Three called Freak of the Week back in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been critical of the way Elektra Records promoted it. Were they just ignoring the fact that this could have been a hit, or was it because of the changes that were taking place in the business?
Well, I took it very personally, which I shouldn't have, because it was a common thing. Well, you know, I called them Neglectra Records at the time, but I was also I was young and mad at the world at that time.
But it's in their best interest to promote potential hits, isn't it?
It is, but they have better luck with just keep putting out new stuff, you know, just put out another new artist. Work that record for one song, and then let's get something else new out there. It was more about content. It wasn't about like getting behind and nurturing a career of an artist, because they can make a lot more money. And honestly, the public and radio just got so much more fickle that second and third singles, people just didn't care. They were just like not investing in a band. It was just investing in a song.
I grew up with a drummer who had a nice career in the music business until sampling came along. And then one day he realized that only four or five drummers were getting all the calls, and everybody else was being replaced by some computer thing.
Still to this day.
And so as a producer, how did you work that out?
Well, I guess I come from a different place where it's always been a little bit more of an organic production, and I'm old-fashioned in that way. And even when I get called to like do a pop record for somebody, I'll still end up using a live drummer, and it freaks people out. They don't even understand it. Some
it
artists
does sound have, different.
Some artists have not even heard. I have them sometimes coming to me going, are you going to use real drums on this? And I'm like, yeah, is that a problem? Some people are like, well, it might be. You know, that's sad that we've kind of got to that, you know, it's almost like, you know, HAL 9000, where, you know, the computer is ruling us instead of the other way around.
In the old days, they used to have these television shows, and they'd play a new record, and they'd ask the kids what they thought, and they'd say, it's got a nice beat.
It's got a nice beat.
Yeah, how important is the beat and the instrumentation for a successful record?
The beat is everything these days, because obviously, to me, as jaded as this might sound, on pop radio, the lyric is obviously not that important. They can be very, repetitious and mundane. So, but the track and the beat and the way it makes people move is everything in pop music, I feel.
So after Marvelous 3 broke up, you began writing songs and producing records for people like Avril Lavigne, Pink, Katy Perry, and you had a lot of commercial success with that. Those are kind of teen artists. How do you get into that mindset?
It's the last thing on earth I thought I would ever be called to do. But it all started because I was still producing a lot of rock and like hard rock records and kind of more punk stuff, I guess, back when I was unknown. As that, and then you just get one call from somebody that likes your record that you did for yourself or a recent record, and they're in the pop world, and then all of a sudden I had a hit song with one of them, and then from there the calls started like just trailing in, and then you got to know where to stop and keep
balancing. But then they want you to repeat what you did with the last artist, don't they?
Yeah, labels mostly. The labels are the ones who are like, make it sound like Adele.
Well, while you were recording My Happy Ending with Avril Lavigne, you said it sounded like a hit. Do you have a sense of a record becoming a hit?
I think you can get too close to it if you're too educated and well versed in it in recording and writing songs. You might get a little too close to it and say like, I think this is special. But one thing that really resonated with me was just that pure teen innocence when I wrote that song with Avril, and Avril looked at me and said, she's the one who said, this is a hit. And I was like, how do you know, little girl?
And
it turned out to be.
I'd like to have a dollar for every time somebody said, this is a hit, and it didn't do anything.
I've said that. I've called a million flunks, you know.
Earlier on the show, we had Robert Lavigne here. He used to be the managing editor or the executive editor at Billboard, and we were talking about record companies and how so many people saw them as evil. And he said, well, a lot of the groups could be evil as well. The artists could be evil as well. There's some artists you don't hide your distaste for, bands like Nickelback and Creed, you mentioned in the book. What did they do to you?
Nothing, actually. I don't really... I hate the fact that I have any negativity in this book, by the way. I guess there's a certain element musically and lyrically, and maybe it's the lead singer thing as well. Maybe just the too much, I don't know, too much bravado, too much
ego,
whatever. I don't know. Maybe it's certain things that they did off the mic and off the stage. Let's put it that way, that I don't need to really embellish on, because most people that know them are probably in agreement with me on that.
Going back to hits, in the past, you had a hit if the radio, the top DJs played it. How do you get a hit today? And if it isn't a DJ who makes a hit, what happened to payola?
Besides favors, money, drugs, the occasional timeshare.
Uh-huh.
I think it was probably nowadays things happen with buzz more than ever, and that's exciting. The internet, obviously, I keep going back to that, but it's the biggest tool for you know, creating hype on something, and all of a sudden something on YouTube that is free and it's out there and it's free reign for people to see, and then the public's deciding on whether or not, instead of one guy in a suit, you know, behind a desk at a record company deciding it, if it's going to be big for the masses. So
Butch Walker was named by Rolling Stone the Hot Producer of the Year in 2005. He continues producing records, but there are new hot producers.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, he's also written a memoir with Matt Deal called Drinking with Strangers, Music Lessons from a Teenage Bullet Belt. It is published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
from the south and lazy. This town stays open too late for these old bones. Maybe it's because it's got too many faces, crammed like fishes in compact places. This is why all of them seem desperate and alone. It's the closest thing.